On March 3, 2018, as part of the Voyager Institute's Music and Film Lecture Series, Heat Rocks went live. Our guest was Justin Simeon, the creator of Dear White People, the film, and the television series for Netflix, whose second season airs tomorrow, May the 4th. His Heat Rock? Michael Jackson's 1995 double album, History, Past, Present, and Future, Book 1. Not only did he slay Oliver and I with his Wikipedia-like knowledge of the album, he also came through rocking a sick sequined glove. Take a listen.
Hello, I'm Oliver Wang.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks. Yay! Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, you know, a banger, flammable, hot tracks. For today, our second live show, we're taking you all on a trip back to 1995 and Michael Jackson's History, Past, Present, and Future, Book 1.
'83 might have been the height of Michael Jackson's pop music success, but by 1995, he was the king of the pop culture world, king of the tabloids, king of scandal. This was a time at which he was still in the midst of allegations of child molestation. His court trials had gone to court in 1993. He was still in the midst of being married for his short-lived marriage to Lisa Marie Presley, and of course, still putting out music. It's worth noting that History, which was a double album, Disc 1 had a greatest hit selection. We're going to be mostly talking about Disc 2, which had all of Michael's new songs, went 20 times platinum. It is considered, I think, one of the best-selling double albums of all time. Right. Certainly another feather in Michael's cap. But in a lot of ways, the musical moment of it was still overshadowed by just the general spectacle of Michael in the mid-90s. And that's definitely what we're going to be getting into today.
To talk about History, we have invited director Justin Simeon. Give it up. Indeed. Some years ago, I heard a preacher describe one of his closest friends this way. He said, quote, "This man knew me. He knew my limitations. He knew that when I got angry, there were certain words I couldn't say. So he'd offer to do it for me. He'd offer to curse for me. Sometimes," he said, "you need someone in your life to say things you can't." Since 2014, our guest has used his wit, his insight, his reach, and his wicked pen game to draw us into reflection, self-examination, and discourse. In the face of trolls and an ever-flammable timeline, he's bravely challenged the status quo and our problematic faves. It remains to be seen whether or not the revolution will be televised, but certainly the revelation already has. As the news bears witness, these are some crazy times. So watch something else. If smart, funny, and occasionally shade-laced takes on politics, culture, and race are your thing, check out a think piece in three words, Dear White People. Because sometimes you need someone in your life to say the things you can't. Oliver and I are thrilled to have the creator of Dear White People on our live show, Justin Simeon. Welcome to Heat Rocks, baby.
And look at the proper attire.
Okay, that intro, though, Morgan, I was like, who is she talking about?
Oh, man, so glad to have you here. And you had choices. There are a gang of albums and a gang of hits, so I have to ask, why History? Why this album?
You know what? History is like one of those albums that, like, people just, there's like a black hole in Michael's, you know, work. And everybody, of course, loves Off the Wall. Everybody loves Thriller. A lot of people love Bad. Yeah. You know, us like 83 babies love Dangerous. Yep. But then, you know, the child allegations happened and we sort of act like his career stopped. But it didn't. He kept making records. And, you know, a lot of times people will even talk about Invincible. Yeah. But History is so seldom talked about. And, you know, it's crazy because, like you said, it is the biggest double disc album of all time. It sold a bunch of copies. And its music videos and its singles had a huge impact in culture. And, you know, I would argue, if you think Michael Jackson's a genius and you don't bang with history, you don't really bang with Michael.
Right.
Because this is his most personal album. This is the only album that he actually went into the studio not even realizing an album was coming out on the other end, okay? Like, he was in there to do a, you know, he owed a record. It was supposed to be a greatest hits record. They brought him in to record a couple songs. And organically, he created this album. That's the only Michael Jackson album like that. Every other album, he goes into the studio and he plans every single. He wants everything for each radio format. You have to understand, Michael is a genius at many things, but what he was most genius at is being a pop star.
Right.
And so, you know, this guy is a black man, 1979, Off the Wall is one of the biggest records ever, but he's still just relegated to the black charts. No Grammy love, no mainstream love. And so from that point on, he was like, you know what, though? I'm coming for him.
Right.
Okay? I'm going to give y'all some rock and roll. I'm going to give y'all some hip-hop, a little hip-hop-laced stuff, some R&B,
right.
Some post-disco. Thriller onward, he is really aiming for hits. This is the one album where this creative genius is just flowing. He's just giving you his heart and giving you his soul.
And I think a lot of that comes out of the allegations. I mean, if Off the Wall is his breakout album, Thriller is his star-making album, Bad is his sexy album, Grown and Sexy, Dangerous is the New Jack album, History is the pissed album.
Yes, it is.
Michael Jackson is pissed.
Mm-hmm.
He's pissed. If you start the second part of that album with Scream, you're pissed. He's like, I'm pissed, and my sister's pissed.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We are both pissed out here.
Not
right?
Only am I furious.
My sister's mad. We're gonna do all types
she
of good.
She mad too.
We're gonna do dance, hand geometry. We're gonna show you how pissed we are.
Yeah, we up in space.
That's it.
Beaming down live.
Right.
We're furious.
And we're gonna start off with "I'm Tired of Injustice." That video, $7 million. It's the most expensive music video ever made.
Wasn't it $9 million? Actually?
Not. It's like $10 million.
I mean, it's
now.
Crazy expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should we watch a little of Scream
please,
right now?
Please, please. I have to ask you, as a director, though, because when I was, if it's $9 million, where is the spend? Like, what made that be so expensive?
Ah, Lord, the things I could make with that money. I mean, first of all, you have Mark Romanek, okay, who is like at the height of his powers.
Sure.
Janet had just worked with him on "Got Till It's Gone," I think is how it's called in the album. And this is a real, first of all, this is probably my favorite video director and one of my favorite directors. His films are often overlooked too. But he spun the idea of telling a story with a video on its head. And instead of telling you a beginning, middle, end kind of story, he told you a story about a place. Each of his videos, he creates these worlds that feel really real and complete. And that's where the money goes. You know, one, you've got Michael and Janet and, you know, Michael ain't necessarily showing up on time at this particular part of his career. But also, like, there was no, he wanted, Michael himself wanted to spare no expense. This is his big comeback, okay? This is a kid who grew up in Motown, all right? Where it's all about spectacle. It's all about glamour. It's all about, yo, I'm here. That's what he was raised on. So this plus the money he had equals Scream.
And Sony spent $30 million to promote this album.
That's right.
And I knew Michael was mad because this was the first time he dropped the F-bomb.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He had never done that before.
He dropped a lot of cuss words on this
he
album.
He did.
Mm-hmm. For Michael.
I wanted to backspin to a point that you were making a moment ago, Justin, which is that this album is largely forgotten as catalog. And I have, you know, I can... comfortable confessing this, for me, it is definitely the album by him that I spent the least of amount of time with. And I think partially it was, for me in 95, 99.9% of what I was listening to was hip hop. So even though he has Biggie on the album.
Listen, I got problems of my own, flashing cameras, taps on on my phone. Even in my home, I ain't safe as I should be. Things always missing. Maybe it could be my friends. They ain't friends if they robbing me, stopping me from making a profit. See, apology shallow like the ocean. I guess I resort to gun token. If I was dead broke and smoking, I'd probably be by my lonesome. I'm a killer nigga.
I just think of Michael in this moment, and then I was saying this in the intro, as his just general dominance in news and media and all aspect of it made it, you kind of forgot that he was still making music during this. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned before that you were born in 83, so you would have been around, what, 12 years old when this came out. I know what Michael Jackson meant to me growing up because I was around the same age when Thriller came out. But what did Michael mean to you around 95?
So, you know, Michael for me was like my first hero. I remember being in kindergarten and it was like, y'all, this is a real story, okay? So it was like after nap time, they would show us one of like two or three movies. And it was like the Care Bear movie. It was some other crap. And it was Moonwalker.
Michael Jackson. Nothing could prepare you for his movie. Moonwalker. It's written in the stars.
And I... Let me tell you something. I, like, campaigned for Moonwalker pre-lunch time, okay? We would, like, get the hot dog day, have our lunch or whatever, and I'd be like, okay, so, you know, after naps, so how about that Moonwalker, though? You know, like, I was, like, obsessed, all right? So this is the first time I, as a little black boy, saw a black man, you know, turning into robots and stuff and, like, shooting magic. And, a shooting star would fly by and he could, like, transform into things. Like, he was magic to me. Like, he actually was magic. And, you know, the skin color thing had already sort of become a topic in the culture. But as a little boy, like, all of that stuff went over my head. You know, like, the idea of what blackness was and was he black enough. I wasn't engaged in that conversation. Like, I was a little kid. My mom is Creole. Black to me looks like all the different colors of the rainbow. So, you know, I didn't see the weird stuff that people were already starting to see at the time. I just saw a black man being the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And so by the time 95 comes around, I'm still a fan. And, you know, I remember that turn, and it happened really truly before Dangerous, honestly, where he wasn't cool anymore to the kids. You know what I mean? Like, I remember everyone, okay, this is also really embarrassing. I remember, like, they were literally trying to kill time, like in this after school thing I went to. And it was like, okay, let's have a talent show. And everyone went up and sang Poison. And I went up and sang Remember the Time. You know what I mean? It was,
yes,
like, that just goes to show you how, first of all, not cool I was, but also, like, the love for Michael was real. And so everyone else was sort of turning on him and gravitating to what at the time, you know, was more in vogue for black people, which was like this gangsta, urban, authentic thing, you know, not realizing that, frankly, you couldn't do that in the 90s if it wasn't for what Michael and Whitney was doing in the 80s. And by this time, they were, you know, kind of whitewashed. That's how they were considered, both of them. And, you know, I just didn't see all of that. So I kept banging with him. And so even during the allegations and the whole trial situation, I still, you know, I was just like, God, I hope he didn't. I was just rooting for him. Yeah. I was like the only one who did. And so when that you know, teaser came out and everyone else saw something ostentatious and, oh my God, how dare he? I was literally like, yes, statue! You know, like, it worked on me, okay? So I listened to that album with different ears.
I mean, that statue and that video is massive. When I look at that video now, the first thing I think is I would have loved to have been in the pitch meeting for that video. When whoever said, listen, we're going to need about 10,000 to 15,000 extras. Mm-hmm. We're gonna put them in uniforms. We're going to do choreography.
We're going to invade Paris, apparently.
Exactly. Yeah. We're going to have a helicopter.
I'm going to be like a vaguely Russian dictator. It's fine. But you know what? Okay, this is going to sound crazy. As ostentatious as it is, it's actually rooted in his experiences. This is really the first album where every creative choice came from an organic, personal place. You know, we're kind of used to it now with Beyonce and, you know, Jay-Z. And I mean, frankly, like, braggadociousness is part of black hip-hop pop culture. Sure. So frankly, a video like this, if Lady Gaga came out with it, like, it really, no one would bat an eyelid. You know, no, there would be no scandal. There's an element of how dare he that's always chased Michael. And it was weird because it was him.
It was weird because it was him. And it was weird because the label was so, like, I mean, the statue floating down the river.
There were
did
actual...
We
there were actual statues floating down actual rivers. like this was like rivers. A real, like, it wasn't just like, oh, let's do an online buy. There's this really funny story. Mark Romanek tells it. They're talking about Scream, but I'm sure it applied to this too. Because he loved to be on phone calls, but not be announced. So he'd be on a phone call with Sony, right? And they'd be like, what are you talking? Why are we spending this kind of money? And the director would be like, well, you know, it's what Michael wants. And they're like, yeah, but we don't, but Michael wants to spare no expense. And all of a sudden you hear, yeah. Yeah, I don't want to spare no expense. And they would just be like, all right, well, you're Michael, so okay.
Right.
And they would float the damn statue down the river.
Exactly.
And you know what? Everybody made money. Okay.
Everybody made
the money. The album made it all back. It wasn't like it was money not well spent. And he obviously is coming out of a place where he has a lot to prove.
I mean, he has, let's see, before this, he's got Thriller, which has sold 46 million, Bad, 22 million, Dangerous, 23 million. The smallest, I think, of that is Off the Wall, 11 million. This made back double what they spent producing it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, people, I remember reading people saying, this is too much money. Why are we doing this? And Michael Jackson was like, yeah, what's in your wallet?
Okay.
We're doing this, and it's done.
So speaking of expense, how did you buy the album? You know, was it on CD, cassette? Like, how did you actually sit with history?
Not only did I buy the album, but I bought a CD player because I didn't have one at the time.
Wow.
I was rocking them cassettes. I was 12. It's fine. And yeah, I got the double, I remember the little like double like Big Mac looking CD packet. And with the gold CDs, I had the first, they are scratched the F up somewhere in somebody's closet in Houston with all the rest of my childhood things. But like, I got the first versions of it with the K word on They Don't Care About Us, all of it. I had the first version. And I remember listening to it on the phone back when you didn't have the internet with my friends and just like listening through each song. And it was like a really big deal for me at the time. And, you know, one of the things that like I feel like people forget about is, and I was talking about this earlier, is like, you know, this was a really big moment in culture because this man went from like the biggest thing of all time to like the bottom of the pop barrel. I mean, like he was just like his only currency was to be made fun of. Yep. That's it. And, you know, that you listen, we're not going to get, that's not the point of this particular podcast, but if we're going to get into the 1993 of it all, the allegations, say what you will about this man's personal life, anybody who looks at that particular case can see a lot of problems.
Right.
Okay. This was before OJ. Okay. This is where all of those things that were in place when the OJ of it all happened were created to make money off of the scandal. This is the first time you have quote-unquote witnesses being paid to show up on new quote-unquote news programs to, you know, read scripts and pretend like that's what really happened. This is the first time where, like, actual, like, television press could influence an actual case, could actually influence the justice system. To us, this is all very passé now. I mean, literally something can trend on Twitter and it can turn the tide of something. But back then, it was all being invented for the first time. So he's not only responding to, you know, like his experience of being accused of child molestation, he's responding to having been through the justice system of America as a black man. And I get it because he's maybe not cis, okay? All right? His gender expression was a little bit different. So was Prince's. It's fine. So was Ziggy Stardust, okay? His gender expression was different. He was dealing with some vitiligo, which we're going to get into in a minute. Had some issues with, you know, had a bunch of issues, okay? All right? Not disputing that. But, like, this is a person who actually went through a very real-world experience that, frankly, is so part of our zeitgeist now. And this is one of our greatest pop artists, and he's speaking about it honestly.
I got to say, if you really think about it, L.A. in that era, L.A. courthouses in that era went from Rodney King to Michael Jackson to O.J. Mm-hmm. Like, the legal system in L.A. was lit in the mid-90s.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was. It was. And I think L.A. was the center of so much drama pushed by media. Before we had the term paparazzi, it was just like the media. We only had a couple of programs. I think Current Affair was one of them. Mm-hmm. Diane Diamond. Does anyone remember Diane Diamond, who was always on the scene? She was small fry. When you worried, was when Diane Sawyer made the call. You didn't want to have that interview with Diane Sawyer because she was going to get in your business.
Uh-huh.
She's the one that made Whitney Houston say, crack is whack. Right?
Sure did.
Show me the receipts.
Mm-hmm.
So when I knew that it was deep for Michael Jackson was when Diane Sawyer sat down with he and Lisa Marie Presley about their situation.
That's right.
And with me, of course, Michael Jackson and Lisa Marie Presley. Welcome to Primetime.
Thank you. Glad you're here.
Thank you. It occurs to me, looking at the two of you, I have got to start by asking how this marriage took place, how it began. Let me guess that it was not over miniature golf and a hot dog someplace. Mm-hmm. When did it start? When was the dating?
Well, we first met, she was 7 years old and I was 17.
Okay, it's already weird. I just want to say.
Okay, don't be pausing, Michael, all right?
This was in Las Vegas. She used to come and see my show all the time. We had the only family show on the Strip. It was the Jackson 5. And she used to come as a little girl and sit right up front. She came quite often, but she came with a lot of bodyguards.
And had you stayed in touch over all these
years?
Sure.
And then she'd come backstage. Then I'd, you know, talk and say hi, and then she'd come again. And I thought she was sweet and loving, and I always hoped I'd see her again.
And who first talked about marriage?
We didn't stay in touch after
We didn't
that.
Stay in touch after that, no.
He had, go ahead, you want to say what happened?
No, you can say. You have a good memory.
No, you said you were going to say it.
Our first argument here on this hour. Who proposed? I mean, how did marriage actually get discussed?
First of all, Diane is so shady. So, looking at the two of you now, how did this... because I see bangs here and I see bangs here. I mean, she's so shady. I kind of love it. And it's also worth pointing out that it was in this interview that he premiered Scream.
You can see people... You know, their reaction. I remember the comments, the reaction to this video, because the gangsterness of Michael Jackson is not only do I own the Beatles catalog, but I have married Elvis
I've
Presley's
married his daughter.
Come
you
see
know,
about me.
That certainly flashed through his brain, I'm sure, when it all went down. But here's the thing. I got to tell this little anecdote, because a lot of questions come up about Michael's sexuality and all this kind of stuff. And I'm a person who's a fan of his. So I've read everything. I've read all the theories. I've literally read everything. And the thing that's so interesting to me is that long after they had their falling out, long after Lisa Marie has said some horrible things about him, long after they were not friends, she still was like, we banged. I mean, like, I get it. But she tells this story in her autobiography that is not flattering, okay, for either party. But it did involve intercourse regularly. And so whatever you might say about that, that was what was going on for them, okay? And, you know, Michael, like, always was like, well, I want to be this. Like, I don't know. Maybe he didn't know how to define it. Maybe we didn't.
Sure.
But, you know, I think he was really tired of being, quote unquote, in the closet about his life.
The Dead Pilot Society podcast brings you hilarious comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Aubrey Plaza, Andy Richter, Paul F. Tompkins, John Hodgman, Adam Scott, Molly Shannon, Busy Phillips, Tom Lennon, Anna Camp, Laurie Metcalf, Felicia Day, Michael Ian Black, Adam Savage, Paul Scheer, Ben Schwartz, Skylar Astin, Mae Whitman, Josh Molina, Ben Feldman, Nicole Byer, Jason Ritter, Sarah Chalk, Steve Agee, Jane Levy, Allison Tolman, Danielle Nicolette, Casey Wilson, Anna Ortiz, Lorraine Newman, June Diane Raphael, Kiernan Shipka, Ed Week, Zach Knight, and Carrie Kenny Silver, John Ross Bowie, Jamie Denbo, Janet Varney, Alexander Torsani, Summer, Ellen Ross, Matt Worley, and many more. Listen at MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you download podcasts.
Hello, are you looking for a new comedy podcast? In which case, can I draw your attention to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast? It's a fictional industry podcast for the beef and dairy industries. It won Best Comedy at the 2017 British Podcast Awards, and it features wonderful guests such as Greg Davis.
To my knowledge, it's the only cow circus that's ever existed in this country. In rural Russia, every small town has a cow circus.
Josie Long.
You should have a beef. Have a beef with them. I have a beef with you. I will have a beef with you. Come round my house and I'll have a beef with you.
And Andy Daly.
That virus never existed. There was never any such thing as a mad cow disease. That was all an illusion that Big Lamb came up with.
That's the Beef and Dairy Network podcast. Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts from. And I would recommend starting at episode 1. Bye.
That first time you were listening through the album and you're on the phone with your friends, and you guys are listening together, what did you think of the album then? And when you have gone back to it in time, especially, let's say, if you revisit it for today, what do you hear differently now that compared to when you were, you know, 12 listening to it?
So when I was listening to it, I was like, I was rooting for Michael, right? So I was like listening for the radio hits, and because I wanted him to have that moment. And you're kind of, you know, so I was like absorbing it. I liked it a lot. I really love Scream. I really love the video. They Don't Care About Us was dope. Stranger in Moscow was amazing. But then you get to You Are Not Alone and you're like, oh, there's the hit, you know? And so I was really listening to it as if I was like his A&R person or something. Like, you know, okay, he should really do a video with this and he should, like, you know, have a more natural hairstyle. Like, that's literally what we're talking about. Surprise, I'm gay. But, like, I was like, I was thinking of it in the lens of, like, his career and how he'd be perceived. And now I listen to it just as a fan of music and as a fan of his music.
Let's take a listen to You Are Not Alone. And Morgan, I think you had some thoughts to say coming out of it.
That's a hit.
Come on.
That was a hit.
Come on.
That was a hit.
First of all, let's talk about history real quick. Okay, so when he went into the studio, not knowing he was about to make history, like not knowing he was about to make a full-fledged album, he hired keyboardists and told them, I want sounds that the ear has never heard. I want beats and I want strings and I want synths that no one has heard yet. There are portions of this album that have 500 tracks. And you think about that, and you don't even hear it the first time around. But think about, like, You Are Not Alone both is a reflection of what was popular at the time, but it sounds like nothing of the time. And the reason why is because even though those beats sound familiar, and even though the strings and the piano, those are all original sounds.
Sure.
That he created custom for this album.
One of my favorite albums on this track, and tracks on this album, and I didn't expect to like it. I had to re-listen to it, is Stranger in Moscow.
Mm.
Stranger in Moscow. Exactly.
It's classic.
It is.
It's classic Michael Jackson. This is actually where the album begins. It's 1993. Michael Jackson owes a song to Sega, of all people, for the Sonic the Hedgehog 3 video game. And so he has producers traveling with him around the world whenever he gets inspired to write this thing, and he didn't. So he's touring Europe, and this is when the allegations break in America. And he is literally walking around Moscow in between sets, and he's pondering the fact that in 1983, his music was not allowed to play in Moscow. It was like black music was banned in Moscow. Mm-hmm. So the only way people were listening to Thriller and Bad and Dangerous was because they bootlegged it. And now it's 1993, and he's banned from his own country, but he's stuck in Moscow where he's performing. And that sort of being in the liminal and not really belonging to any place anymore, feeling like your entire country has turned its back on you, and you're in a place where literally a decade before you were not allowed to step foot in, that is where Stranger in Moscow came from. This is the first time that Michael is being real with you. He's not putting up a facade. He's not sort of, you know, he's wearing the extensions he wants to wear in the video. He's wearing the mascara he wants to wear. He's producing the song. He's not going off of anyone else's keys. He's not following a radio trend. This is the song he wanted to make. This is a song that was in his heart and in his soul. And he's revisiting his, like, most iconic images in order to sort of, like, give them a new sense of authenticity. And say what you will about it, but I think that's one of the most beautiful songs on the record.
Yeah, and one of my favorites.
And, you know, in a lot of ways, you guys talked about Rhythm Nation. For me, this album is his response to Rhythm Nation. Rodney Jerkins tells a story about how when he walked into the studio to make Invincible, he had a CD of Rhythm Nation and said, "This is the one to beat." Mm. Michael thought that Michael died believing that Rhythm Nation was the best pop album ever made. But he couldn't access the realness, the authenticity, the rawness of it. He couldn't comment on what it was like to be a normal, everyday person. He couldn't comment on the justice system or criminality. He had to actually, like, go through it. And, you know, it's not, I don't think, a coincidence that he's working with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis on this album. Because, for, you know, he always came in trying to beat Rhythm Nation. And this was the first time he actually, I think, felt connected to all these issues he was hearing about. You know, he had been hearing about all of these issues and knew them intellectually. But only having gone through the system, noticed how he was treated differently than others, could he really, like, heart and soul connect with that guy lying on the street who felt disenfranchised. And that's why I think he has the big crazy Nutballs trailer and the big crazy videos, because he knows it's going to take a lot to get people to do that, to lean in and integrate all these things about Michael Jackson that we don't want to. You know, like, the culture at the time wants to pretend like Michael Jackson just stopped after 1991. And he's saying, no, I'm still here. And I want you to see all of me.
Right. I mean, I think as personal as many of the songs on here are, no single track captures the element that you're talking about, the childhood.
Have you seen my childhood? I'm searching for that wonder in my youth. Like pirates in adventurous dreams, a conquest.
Shout out to the Free Willy 2 soundtrack that this song was originally
Free Wills
composed for.
This was a hard video for me to watch as a kid because it was not cool at all. It just wasn't. It was like, yo, man, you seen the new Michael video? It's like, it didn't, you know what I mean? It was really hard for me to watch it.
Peter Pan fans would have had fun with it, I'm
sure. But again, it's because he's asking us to do a lot. He's asking us to square, you know, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, Michael, with the Michael that he's been this whole time. One of the things I love about this album is that it really does hit upon so many issues that we're dealing with right now. We're talking about mass shootings. We're talking about little boys that grow up feeling disenfranchised. This song is about that experience. I feel him. I feel him on this.
And there's a different level of honesty. I mean, we had moments with Michael taking on people and the paparazzi and the media. Leave Me Alone is a great video about what's going on, and it's almost like him sort of poking fun at the media's obsession with him.
Yeah.
So just leave me alone.
They don't care about us as hurt. Mm-hmm. The difference is pain.
Yes.
This, a whole bunch of years have come and gone. And although I do think They Don't Care About Us is a hot mess of a video, there's a whole lot going on. There's the strength is in the craziness of it.
Remember when Beyonce, like, kind of alluded to black oppression at the Super Bowl? And, like, the alt-right, like, was like, oh, my God, she's calling for a riot. So, imagine Michael Jackson in 1995 trying to do that, okay?
Crazy.
And the reason why people, like, were like, is because he's like, I'm a victim of, he's, like, owning the parts of him that are black. Not necessarily looking like a black man, but look at that video again.
Right.
Michael is not wearing makeup. And you can see the blotches all over his body. You can actually see his vitiligo. You can see the black parts. You can see the white parts. You can see his skin literally being eaten away. And he's this is Michael Jackson, so he's aware of what he looks like, okay? His shirt is open. He's dancing. He's dancing with these brown kids. He's trying to let you know, like, I get it. I get that you don't get that I get it, but I get it. And for a person like Michael, who's so image conscious, to be out here with vitiligo blotches showing, and to this day, people don't think he has it, to me, that's kind of a big deal. And nobody, he didn't call attention to it. He didn't talk about it. People don't talk about it, but it's a real thing.
I'm going to put you to a tough question here. If you had to pick the fire track off this album, what would it be?
The
fire track.
All right. You know what? I'm going to pick an unconventional choice, because here's the deal. I could pick They Don't Care About Us, and I could definitely pick Scream. But I'm actually going to pick Tabloid Junkie, because for me, Tabloid Junkie was my favorite song on the album as a kid, and it remains my favorite song on the album. Sonically, it's bizarre. Sonically, it doesn't sound like anything else. And yet it predicts and describes this state of misinformation that we're in currently to a T. Okay? Actually, I'm going to read from this book. Hold on. Give me just a second.
And what book is this you got up here?
All right. So this is called Man and the Music. It's by Joseph Vogel. And it's the only, like, Michael Jackson biography that actually, like, is just about the artistry. It's just about the music. So it's one of my favorites.
Let's take a listen to the song, and then you can tell us
absolutely
what you have to say coming out of it. Homosexual. Ooh, that new jack swing.
Sure.
Woo. Okay.
Is Teddy Riley on this?
Or? No, this is actually Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis.
Okay.
And actually, like, the reason why I think this is also another important album, it is a response, in my opinion, to Rhythm Nation. But it's also really, truly, this is the end of New Jack Swing. This is the last New Jack Swing album.
Right.
And it's actually, like, it's kind of subtle. Because the swing beats actually come from his beatboxing. It doesn't come from the snare drum. It doesn't, like, make a big deal of the beat of the swing beats. But in fact, this is where that genre ends. And for just a music lover, I think that's interesting and important. But let me just read this passage from this book again. It's called Man and the Music by Joseph Vogel. And he says, Tabloid Junkie is deftly constructed, sonically layered. The percussion is once again built on Jackson's beatboxing, Justin Timberlake. 4.5-minute polemic that demands truth and accountability. Rolling Stone described the track as a mammoth funk rock construction with lush vocal harmonies and quick-voiced warnings about the failings of media truth. Mm. Indeed, in an age when the mainstream media and tabloid coverage are conflated more than ever, when celebrity obsession consistently trumps far more than important news, and undiscerning viewers are frequently distracted from or deceived about the truth, Jackson's song remains a relevant rebuttal and warning. This is in 1995. And if this song doesn't describe where we are as a news culture, I don't know what else does. And that's why, for me, history, you know, when we first started talking about this podcast, I'd been going through a re-listen period with it. And what struck me so much is just how much is about what we're talking about right now. They Don't Care About Us is the Black Lives Matter, should be the Black Lives Matter anthem. I mean, it literally is. It goes through all of the things that movement is about. Tabloid Junkie is all about misinformation. And it's all about the infotainmentizing of the news, which was happening really for the first time in the late 80s and early 90s. Again, I really, when I think about the school shootings, I go to history, I go to They Don't Care About Us, and I go to childhood. So many of these songs are actually, you know, what he's trying to say is like, guys, I get it, I'm Michael. I live in a spaceship, I got it. But I've been through some things, and I have some things to say about these things now. And every one of these songs, the lyrics, the production value, these are the most bountifully produced songs about the stuff that we're going through right now. And for me, it's just like it's just become an album that I listen to more now than I ever did.
Well, I have to thank you for bringing this back to my attention, because this also wasn't my favorite album.
I know, right?
But I had to re-listen to it, because I think what I missed, and maybe a lot of people miss this, is I grew up with the star, the big star, Michael, the huge pop star.
Right.
So this for me was like me coming back to his humanity, and I needed this album to be able to see him as human,
yeah.
Stop seeing him as a pop star.
Yeah.
And listening to these 30 tracks again, even the sequencing to me is brilliant. It's a brilliant album, and you know, confession is good for the soul, and I just didn't give it the shot that I should have given it. So,
it's his lemonade.
Absolutely.
Before we knew a lemonade was a thing.
I have to ask you, and I've asked this question before, you know, putting this album into perspective, history, is it ahead of its time, right on time, or timeless?
It's way ahead of its time and timeless. Again, this album is made of three parts, okay? You have his sort of personal love for hip hop and New Jack Swing. Because,
right.
Again, these are not hits. Tabloid Junkie was not a radio single. So he's just expressing himself the way he loves to in these fast tempo songs. And then it's part sort of like social justice, you know? But then it's also part like show tune. Like childhood,
yeah.
History, Little Susie. These are show tunes. These are songs that actually he'd been making his whole career. If you go back and you listen to Someone in the Dark, which he recorded in 1984 for E.T., not released. That song, childhood, history, Little Susie, they're all from the same ilk.
When someone in the dark reaches out to you and touches all the spark, echoes shining. It tells you never be afraid.
He was making these songs forever, but he could never release them because he was Michael. So to me, like, the album is just, it really is his heart. And again, if you bang with Michael, how you gonna bang with him if you don't listen to his heart? Right. He called this his musical book, his musical autobiography. Janet was doing that every album. This is the only album we have from Michael where he does that.
If there was a contemporary artist that you would like to hear try to cover one of the songs off of here, what would the song be and who would the artist be?
Mm. Kendrick Lamar, Scream.
I like that you just knew that instantly, like no hesitation. Woo!
I have no idea what that would sound like, but I'm ready. My ears are ready.
Who would play Janet in this collaboration here?
I don't know. SZA, whoever's hot. I love SZA. That or They Don't Really Care About Us, also Kendrick. I just feel like it's so connected. Like, you know, we live in an era where now you can be unapologetically black from, like, the age you're born to when you do it. Michael didn't grow up in that era. Like, this is as close to woke as a person who gets famous when they're five. As a little black boy in Gary and Ann in the 50s, like, this is the closest you can get to woke from that experience.
Sure.
And there's just a real connection lyrically with what Kendrick is talking about. Beyonce, you know, she really has been trying to, like, dedicate her newer music to real social issues, connecting her personal experience to the larger global experience. That's exactly what Michael is doing in this album, and something that no other pop stars were doing at this time. The hits on the radio right now were, like, you know, If You Want to Be My Lover by the Spice Girls. Like, no one was doing this. So, you know.
That's sort of a jam, too.
I'm saying it's a bop.
It's a bit of a jam.
I'm just saying, if you want to be my lover, lyrically speaking, you know, we're not
it's
talking
limited.
About the same stuff.
Sure.
All right?
Sure.
I'm just saying that he wasn't aiming for pop.
Right.
And for a person like Michael, like, that is kind of crazy. Like, his whole, even after this album, he was aiming for pop.
Sure.
So that's why, that's one of the many reasons I think it's an important revisit.
If you had to define this album in three words, what would they be? For me, they would be, I am human.
Mm. That one works. I am me, I guess, is what it keeps repeating in my head over again. He's asking you to integrate all the things that he is because he's never been able to.
Right.
Pop culture never let him integrate his gender expression. Listen, we have the tools to call these things what they are now. Pop culture didn't let him integrate his gender expression, his pain over being Joseph's son, his confusion over what love means. You know, like, what does it mean to be adored by billions of people but not know what love is? You know, in 1983, you go back and you look at those interviews from Thriller. And again, we think of him as this, like, magnanimous, like, amazing pop. In those interviews, he's like, I've never had a best friend.
Right.
This guy's in his 20s. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know, man. I am me. He's asking you to, like, integrate all the things that we think he is plus what he actually is. And it's a tall order, and not everybody was ready in 1995, but my little 12-year-old self was. And I encourage y'all to get ready because it really is a remarkable album.
Well, thank you for bringing it to our attention. I was surprised that you picked this album when I asked you. for some reason, I just knew. I was like, oh, no, he's going with Frank Ocean, and I'm already ready for it. So when you said Michael Jackson, we were like, wait,
I mean, I'll come back. You next know, time. I can talk about...
I just want to remind you guys that Justin Simien is the creator of Dear White People, and another season is forthcoming. You need to check for it.
But I will tell you this. If you haven't watched the show, watch it, okay? Because I'm trying. I'm out here struggling, okay? I don't got Insecure's marketing budget.
And where can people find you on the socials?
So I'm jsim07 on pretty much everything. Or you can just Google my name and you can find me. Dear White People's on Netflix.
Yes.
Again, if you haven't watched it, now would be a good time to catch up because it is coming very soon, this new season.
Another big hand for Justin. Thank you so much.
Like Michael Jackson Wikipedia. This is dope.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wang, and Morgan Rhodes. Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Thanks to him for that. Heat Rocks is produced by myself, Morgan Rhodes, Shayna Deloria, and Kara Hart. And today's show was engineered and edited by Kara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and executive producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Max Fun family, taping every week live in the neighborhood of Westlake in Los Angeles.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Heat Rocks Pod. You can find a link to our Facebook group on our webpage, heatrockspod.com. That's where we'll post show notes for every single episode, including a track listing of everything you've heard today and more goodies. Again, that's at heatrockspod.com. We would also like to thank our social media supporters, especially those on Twitter, that have kept us so held down and so supported. We love all the tweezies and the retweezies, especially from Andrew Cuddle UK. Thank you, Andrew. Cool name. Connor Koshi Lennon at Beast Rune on Twitter, and Khaled Osman. Again, thank you so much for always mentioning the show and mentioning specific episodes. We do so love the support, and Oliver and I thank you so much. Good to see you, Oliver.
Good to see you too, Morgan. And before you guys leave, here is a teaser from next week's episode of Heat Rocks.
If you had to teach Anita Baker, and if you decided, well, I'm just going to teach compositions, what song do you start out with first?
I would start with Love to the Letter, actually, which was written by James McBride, who also wrote for her on Giving You the Best That I Got. She really did have a knack for understanding who she needed to write with, who she needed to sing and perform with. And so James McBride becomes one of those people. And Love to the Letter, again, is just... It's not like any other song on this album.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.